This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
This week on Living Planet, we're focusing on new moves to save what's left of the Earth's wildlife.
It's very clear already that very large numbers of species are responding to climate change. They're moving their distributions at many species at a kilometre or more per year, moving towards the north in the northern hemisphere or to the south in the southern hemisphere.
Zoos hold an amazing diversity that can be directed to captive breeding for then future reintroductions, for example.
It's very untested at the moment and fraught with difficulties because most of the problems that we currently have with conservation are to do with species being moved around the planet.
And from BP's cleanup dispersants to Chernobyl's sarcophagus, we'll be looking at some of the learned and forgotten lessons of two energy disasters. I'm Nathan Witkop. Welcome to the show. From white rhinos to Californian condors and Indian tigers, recent years have seen some marvellous conservation success stories. Yet the overall picture remains grim. One-fifth of the world's vertebrate species is threatened. Last month, a team of researchers at Germany's Max Planck Institute published a paper in the journal Science calling for zoos to become the planet's future arks. They say zoos already hold a surprising number of endangered animals, but they could do far more for conservation, as Jonathan Gifford found out.
A visit to the zoo can conjure up all sorts of feelings: fascination, fear, empathy, perhaps even pity. Maybe you've felt this way yourself, seeing two lonely white rhinos or a bored-looking Sumatran tiger pacing around its pen. But for Dalia Conde, a researcher at Germany's Max Planck Institute, zoos have a more important function than entertaining humans.
When you see a zoo, you cannot see how they can contribute towards conservation because you visit a zoo and maybe you see three elephants and you see a small group of chimpanzees. However, if you look at zoos as a network, you can see that together they have sizable populations for some species. So it is key that zoos work as a big family in order to be able to reach sizable populations for captive breeding.
Dalia is part of a group of scientists from the Max Planck Center for Demographic Research that has come to the conclusion that zoos are going to be our environmental insurance providers. Despite the efforts of conservationists, the world is facing record losses of species. According to the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, the IUCN, almost one in five vertebrates is threatened. Their numbers have declined by a third since the 1970s. In a paper published in Science magazine, the Max Planck researchers argue that zoos' captive breeding programs will be crucial if conditions in the wild continue to deteriorate.
Zoos hold an amazing diversity that can be directed to captive breeding for then future reintroductions, for example.
Fernando Colchero is one of the Max Planck researchers.
Zoos hold a very large percentage of species that IUCN has labeled as endangered, in some degree of endangeredness, and therefore zoos, with proper management, zoos can provide a tool for conservation in the wild.
The research looked for the first time at the populations of threatened species maintained in the world zoos. These are species cited in the IUCN's Red List, which ranks species conditions from near threatened to extinct in the wild. Dalia Conde says the team encountered some surprising results.
Our first surprise was that we didn't know how many of the world species were represented in zoos and how many of the threatened species were represented in zoos. And we Google how many of the world species are in zoos, so how many threatened species in zoos. And suddenly I got many hits that were 2,000 or 2,050. And I say, that's not possible. When I opened, it was for the Facebook game Zoo. We knew how many species we have for a Facebook game, but we didn't know how many of our planet species were at zoos.
The team found that of all the animals in the world facing some degree of threat, one in seven is already being maintained in zoos, like here at Leipzig Zoo in Germany's east. It's widely recognized for its strong conservation projects. A giant tropical greenhouse is in the final stages of construction. The 16,500-metre or 27-hectare Gondwanaland enclosure, which opens in July. The plans are for the giant exhibit to raise money for the critically endangered Sumatran rhino population on Borneo in Indonesia. Dr. Jörg Junhold is the zoo's director.
Conservation plays a major role behind all the programs we have and behind the whole development of the zoos. I mean, conservation is the basis for a zoo in the 21st century, and we see all our animals just as ambassadors for their native species, which have difficulties to survive in their wild habitats.
The vast Gondwanaland enclosure will be home to some 40 species of animal, including the pygmy hippopotamus, the two-toed sloth, the giant otter and the Komodo dragon, all of which are endangered in the wild.
I'm sure that we can still do more for conservation as the zoo community. And it's not only money. I think it's also to be partner and as an expert in wild animal management and management of small populations, and to be part of the global conservation community. It's not only money, I think it's more.
The money Junhold refers to is the $350 million a year zoos contribute to maintaining threatened species. That includes habitats in the wild. It makes them the third most important source of funding for conservation worldwide, after the Nature Conservancy and the World Wildlife Fund Global Network. But which is more important right now? Captive breeding or efforts to preserve in the wild? Zoos are clearly involved in both, but is an expansion of captive breeding an admission of defeat? Fernando Colchero of the Max Planck Institute doesn't think so.
And actually we insist that captive breeding needs to be like a last resort. For some species, this can be the only way. There's many examples, for example, of amphibians that have lost completely their habitat, but entire populations have been moved into zoos, and very strong and in many cases very successful captive breeding programs have been achieved. But at the same time, there's the option of restoring a habitat in the wild. Therefore, if the zoos can allow us not to lose these populations and actually to provide a source of individuals to be reintroduced into the wild.
I think the problems in the wild are so important and they are so big that we have to do something, and that we have to ensure that we have the populations, because some of the animals in the wild won't be there within the next 10-15 years, and then they are only in the zoos, and we have to make sure that we do the right things and that we manage these populations so they stay on the long run in very healthy conditions.
In any event, if the current rate of worldwide species loss isn't reversed soon, then the choice between more captive breeding and more conservation may well become a moot point. Jonathan Gifford, Deutsche Welle Radio, Leipzig.
While zoos are being recognised as key centres for conservation, the impact of climate change has brought some experts to the conclusion that more radical solutions are needed to save vulnerable species. One such idea is called translocation, moving species from one area or country and releasing them into the wild in another. In fact, just this week, the British billionaire Richard Branson stirred up a hornet's nest when he said he would use one of his private Caribbean islands to provide a new home for Madagascar's lemurs. As Robin Powell reports from London, translocation is seen as a highly risky strategy.
When it comes to moving plants and animals around the globe for our own benefit, man doesn't have a particularly glorious record. One of the most commonly cited examples is the devastating impact that the South American cane toad and European fox have had on Australia's native species. The UK, meanwhile, is losing its fight against Japanese knotweed, as well as the so-called killer shrimp that has already rampaged through European waterways. It's no surprise, therefore, that the conservation movement is very cautious about the idea of introducing non-native species into new ecosystems. So the suggestion that we start doing this deliberately in a process called translocation has caused something of a stir. Professor Chris Thomas from York University says global warming means we must now start taking translocation seriously.
It's very clear already that very large numbers of species are responding to climate change. They're moving their distributions at many species at a kilometre or more per year, moving towards the north in the northern hemisphere or to the south in the southern hemisphere. So that means that species, if they're going to survive in the long run, have got to be able to get to places that are in the future going to have both suitable habitats for them and a suitable climate.
And that's where humans come in.
It could be just moving it to another habitat that's very close to where it currently lives, or it could involve actually moving it much longer distances, and that particularly might need to be the case under climate change, when there are changes in the places that are going to be suitable for a given species.
Whether it involves short or long distances, Graham Madge from the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds points out that we can't predict what will happen when new species are released into the wild.
It's very untested at the moment and fraught with difficulties because most of the problems that we currently have with conservation are to do with species being moved around the planet and posing threat to other native species. So it's not something that's going to be undertaken lightly.
The best known cautionary tale about invasive species in the UK is the red squirrel's battle for survival against the now ubiquitous grey squirrel, first brought over from North America over 100 years ago. Chris Shuttleworth from the Red Squirrel Survival Trust says the impact of the grey is a lesson we need to learn.
It only has to go wrong once, and that will have an impact on all the other proposals, no matter how good the science sounds. People will, it'll be a case of once bitten, twice shy. We don't want to have a whole load of new species that are creating as many problems as the grey squirrel has done in the UK.
Chris Thomas points out, however, that even if the red squirrel were to die out in the UK, it would live on in its European habitats. In fact, he gives this as one reason why the UK would be an ideal destination for translocating species.
By and large, almost all of the species in Britain occur quite widely across Europe, and many of them occur quite widely across Asia as a whole. So even if one or two native species were to die out as a result of new introduced species, actually, as long as the introduced species was retained within Britain, then it wouldn't kill off the species as a whole.
The International Union for the Conservation of Nature first published its widely recognised position paper on translocation in 1987. Subsequent IUCN guidelines describe introducing alien species to new habitats as a last resort, but they still don't mention climate change. Mark Stanley Price is leading the IUCN team tasked with updating the guidelines again. He indicated what the new proposals on what he calls conservation introduction may contain.
We're seeing much more small-scale moves within the same bioregional zone just to help species along. And it will really be species which are probably naturally rare, have very specific climate conditions, probably very complex biological relationships, and are not very mobile.
So how much time do we have? Stanley Price, in common with most conservationists I talk to, believes that despite the risks, conservation introduction will at some point be used as a way of preserving global biodiversity. Thomas warns that we mustn't wait too long.
If you just sort of relax about this, the problem can be that a species appears to be surviving quite well within its current distribution, and it's all going okay. Suddenly we hit a new extreme event and it's gone almost immediately, and so before we really noticed that there was a major problem.
And with that warning, it seems the conservation movement will soon have to face up to translocation as a potentially risky but vital tool in saving vulnerable species from climate change. Robin Powell, Deutsche Welle Radio, London.
Time for a look now at some other environment stories making news this week. Here's Holly Fox.
Eco News.
Japan has banned entry into a 20-kilometer evacuation zone around its crippled nuclear power plant at Fukushima. Many residents left the area in the wake of the accident, which was triggered by a massive earthquake and tsunami on the 11th of March. The government says it will allow one person per family to return to homes for a maximum of 2 hours to collect valuables. The nuclear plant operator says it will likely take 6 to 9 months to bring its stricken reactors under control. Scientists at Imperial College London say they have found a way to fight malaria by genetically manipulating large populations of mosquitoes. The team has demonstrated how just a few mosquitoes with small genetic changes can pass on their genes to a large population over the span of a few generations. The altered genes prevent the mosquitoes from transmitting malaria parasites to humans. Malaria kills around 850,000 people annually, most of them children. The study was published in this week's issue of Nature. Southeast Asian nations failed to resolve a dispute this week over plans for a controversial dam in northern Laos. The impoverished communist country said there was no need for further consultations following a meeting with its neighbors in the capital, Vientiane. Laos is seeking to build a $3.5 billion dam on the Mekong River. It sees hydropower as vital to its future. Neighbors and environmentalists are concerned about the dam's impact on farmland and fish species. Vietnam, Thailand, and Cambodia say there haven't been enough studies into the project's impact. The International Energy Agency says biofuels could provide nearly a third of the world's transportation fuel by the middle of the century. The IEA said in a report this week that the technology could prove essential to reducing carbon emissions in the transport sector, provided it is harvested sustainably. It said many of today's next-generation biofuels would need to be commercialized within the next decade to meet this goal. Conventional biofuels, such as ethanol from sugar, corn, or wheat, have been heavily criticized for impacts on forests and world food supplies.
That was Holly Fox with the Eco News. And if you're looking for more environment content, come check out our webpage. That's dwworld.de/environment. Thanks to all of you who've started following our new Twitter account. We're up to 95 followers now, so help us get into the triple digits. The account is DW_eco, that's E-C-O. We're using it to let people know about stories as well as stuff we're reading or stumbled across online. Hopefully we'll also be able to start letting you know about upcoming program ideas too. Coming up, lessons from energy disasters old and recent. Oil and water don't mix, and this week, last year, the world was again reminded of that when BP's Deepwater Horizon drilling rig exploded and sank off the United States Gulf Coast. The accident killed 11 workers and spilled more than 800 million litres of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. While experts are still investigating the long-term environmental impacts of the disaster, others are preparing to cope with the next catastrophe. Norway has a long tradition with oil, and scientists at its SINTEF research organisation were among specialists from around the world who were roped into BP's emergency efforts last year. Irene Quayle paid a visit to the lab in Trondheim that, among other things, investigates exactly what happens when oil meets water.
This is a larger system where we try to simulate the main environmental parameters after an oil spill. This is filled with seawater where we apply approximately 10 liters of fresh oil. And then we have these different natural processes by wave action. We have the sun there. And then we follow the weathering of the oil, typically for 3 days.
But oil is not just oil, as SINTEF senior scientist Svein Ramstad explains on the tour of the lab. Hundreds of different oil types are stored and tested in the Trondheim facility, from light oils which evaporate quickly to heavy types which stay in the sea much longer and can drift a long way. The lab temperature is set on cool today, but last year the heat was on here, the thermometer set to 32 degrees as experts rushed to analyse samples taken from the oil gushing into the Gulf of Mexico. Detailed information on how different oils are influenced by temperature, salinity or ocean currents are a prerequisite for dealing with any oil spill, says Ramstad's colleague Per Dolling, who has been working on oil for more than 25 years. The oil spill response team has to decide when oil can be pumped off, burnt on site or treated with chemical dispersants. Dolling specialises in dispersants, which are used to make oil more accessible to oil-eating microbes.
There were a lot of learnings, definitely. In Norway, we were looking on the possibility to inject oil spill dispersants at the sea bottom in an underwater blowout for about 20 years ago. That was the first time was done in a real situation during the incident in the Gulf of Mexico. And I think that is a new technique that deserves to be looked more detail into. What will be the fate and what will be the environmental effects of that?
SINTEF is currently developing a new method of dispersing oil using high-pressure water jets instead of chemicals. The project is scheduled to be completed in around a year. Amongst the customers for oil response technologies is the Norwegian Clean Seas Association, NOFO, which represents the 29 oil companies operating on the Norwegian continental shelf. NOFO consultant Jørn Harald Andersen says the Deepwater Horizon incident left a strong impression on his organization.
We recognize quite a few of the same challenges in the Gulf as we have been observing here in Norway, which is, of course, the ability to make sure that all the response equipment is located where the recoverable oil actually is. And since the oil is drifting and the resources are also moving, it's a very demanding task. So we think that the remote sensing and good guiding from remote sensing sources is quite important to utilize the response resources in an optimal way.
Satellite data and high-tech aircraft can help plot the path an oil slick is likely to take and identify the part of it which can be recovered or treated. That's generally only about 10%. The rest evaporates or is too thin to be separated from the water. It's hard to see the difference from the bridge of a ship, says Anderson. Dr. Amy McFadden, an oceanographer with the emergency response team from the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, says remote sensing is vital, as was shown in the Deepwater Horizon operation.
One of the things that we learned was just the value of having real-time observations to inform the models so that we could do a much better job in prediction. So the value of coastal ocean observing systems that could provide data that we could use in a rapid manner.
1 year after the Deepwater Horizon catastrophe, McFadden says the oil blowout has heightened awareness of the potential risks of oil exploration. Accidents do happen, says the US expert, and that leads SINTEF scientist Per Dolling to draw clear conclusions.
To be prepared for that, it is important to do a good planning and also do that investigation of this different oil types and also to improve the technology also in peacetime between this, and not only when you have the spill there. It is important that you have a continuously research and development within this area.
Irene Quayle, Deutsche Welle Radio, Trondheim.
Another anniversary due to fall before next week's show is the 25th anniversary of the world's worst nuclear catastrophe to date, the Chernobyl disaster of the 26th of April 1986. This week, an international donors conference fell a couple of $100 million short of its target of $1 billion for further cleanup work. Among other things, the money is supposed to provide the site's reactor with a new containment structure. The current one, often referred to as a sarcophagus, is in a perilous state. But as Marijke Arden reports from Chernobyl, money is far from the only problem.
Внимание, внимание! Уважаемые товарищи! Городской совет...
It was around lunchtime on the 27th of April 1986 when the citizens of Pripyat heard this evacuation message on the radio. It had been over 30 hours since the explosion at block number 4 of the Chernobyl nuclear plant. The 50,000 people of Pripyat, most of them workers at the plant, would never return to their homes. They left behind them a ghost town. In the months after the explosion, hundreds of thousands of workers and reservists from across the Soviet Union were sent to Chernobyl to stabilize the situation and to build a shelter. They built the so-called sarcophagus around reactor number 4.
The sarcophagus is a big problem today here at Chernobyl. It's ramshackle and could collapse soon.
Tobias Münchmeier is an expert from Greenpeace Germany. He is accompanying a group of journalists on a tour of the exclusion zone.
It was provisionarily stabilized. You can see the scaffold there. But the engineers themselves say that even this will only work for another 5 to 10 years. So it's quite urgent to find a solution, or rather another interim solution. It won't be anything else.
For the past 25 years, there has been a heated debate about what lies beneath the sarcophagus. Some experts say 95% of the nuclear fuel was released at the time of the catastrophe. Others say that perhaps only 5% was released. Mikhail Umanets is among those most familiar with what was in the plant at the time. He was director of Chernobyl from 1987 to 1992.
Maybe there's even more inside, but our investigations indicate that there are 2,000 kilograms of uranium-235 and 480 kilograms of plutonium-232. We are not talking about radioactive waste. These are radioactive materials out of which bombs are made. The potential danger around the sarcophagus hasn't decreased during the last 25 years. It is getting worse every day.
Chernobyl's sarcophagus was only designed as an interim solution. Today it is cracked and unstable and needs to be replaced. Greenpeace nuclear expert Heinz Smietal fears what may happen if it disintegrates.
There could be a huge cloud of dust if the reactor collapses. Inhaling that dust could turn out to have deadly consequences. It could spread hundreds of kilometers, carried further and further by winds and water.
Weggespült werden würde. In 2007, a French consortium won a tender to build a replacement chamber for Chernobyl. The structure will be 108 meters high and weigh around 20,000 tons. It will use rails to slide over the current sarcophagus and costs an estimated 1.6 billion euros. The project's international donors include the European Union. Progress has been hampered by complications and deadlines have already been pushed back 3 times. The project is currently slated for completion in 2016, but Heinz Smietal is skeptical.
Ukrainian experts constantly talk of how urgently this problem needs to be solved. Internationally, there are always pleas for more funds for the new sarcophagus. Yet all the delays leave you thinking that for some people there is no rush. Western contractors are earning well, irrespective of the product they're delivering.
Smietal says corruption and high levels of radiation at the site are aggravating construction delays. The new container won't be a permanent solution either. Former Chernobyl director Mikhail Umanets is dismayed that the new container is only expected to last for another 100 years.
Absolutely.
It totally fails to fulfill its purpose. They even changed the name. They used to talk about containment. Now it's just confinement. Those are completely different things. The first plan was to reprocess the fuels underneath the shelter, not only confine them. But this will never happen now. We're leaving a mess for the next generation. What will they do with it? We won't be alive then. Maybe that's why too few people care.
And the sarcophagus is far from the only problem at the plant. Other legacies include over 800 pits of highly radioactive scrap, a huge pond of radioactive water, and the health of thousands of people in the area prone to a higher risk of cancer. Mareike Aden, Deutsche Welle Radio, Chernobyl. Una lengua común.
And that brings us to the end of this week's show. Remember, the website for more of our environment content is dwworld.de/environment. And that Twitter account, again, is dw_eco. You can also find Living Planet as a podcast. Do a search in any search engine to find us for that. Thanks for listening. I'm Nathan Whitcop. Catch you again next week.
Del campo y de la sierra, y tois hasta Portugal. Del baile y de la siembra, del hierro a Madagascar. Del campo y de la sierra, de Itois hasta Portugal. Del baile y de la siembra, del hierro a Madagascar.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.